This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Federal government's taking its first steps towards regulating artificial intelligence, saying new safeguards are needed to protect us. AI is developing rapidly, with advice to government saying it'll affect everything from banking to education and creative industries, while others are warning it could lead to human extinction. The federal government's releasing a discussion paper today, and the Minister for Science and Industry, Ed Husic, joined me earlier. Ed Husic, welcome to AM.
Good morning.
Artificial intelligence makes it so hard to know what's real. There's so much misinformation. How can the government beef up regulation?
I think everyone recognises AI has become a part of their lives, and they do obviously appreciate some of its benefits, but I think there's sort of a feeling in the community that they want to have the assurance, the confidence that the technology isn't getting ahead of itself and that's not being used in a way that creates disadvantage or risk for people. And that's why, as a government, the Albanese government wants to basically set upon the next reforms that can give people confidence that we're curbing the risks, maximising the benefits and giving people that, as I said, that assurance that the technology is working for us and not the other way around.
What do you have in mind? The discussion paper that's been released flags things like facial recognition and social scoring. China uses those things. Would they be banned here?
We're opening it up for broad discussion. We want, as we shape up the next reforms into the way in which AI gets regulated in this country, we want to invite not just people that are involved in technology, but we want the broader public and others to have their say as well. There's probably, Sabra, close to about a dozen different laws at the moment that in one way or other give some regard to the impact of technology, particularly like AI. Whether or not we're able to say with full confidence that those laws are keeping up with technology and the developments that we've seen over the last 6 months, for example, well, that's why we're doing the consultation. We want to make sure that Australia's got a fit-for-purpose regulatory regime when it comes to AI, particularly what we're seeing around generative AI. And again, the aim is to give people confidence that we're curbing the risk and maximising the benefit of new technology.
As you say, the technology is racing ahead. Have public schools been too quick to ban ChatGPT?
Well, my colleague and friend Jason Clare the other day has basically referred to the House of Representatives Education Committee, an inquiry into the use of AI in education. And I do know that states and territories, they're already starting to think about this as well, Sabra. And again, it's about recognising there are, in some cases, people use ChatGPT to help enhance the way they do their research, but we've also got to ensure that the way that that is done is proper, that people are confident and that people are comfortable with the way that that's being used. And in an education sense, you want kids to go through the full education learning process and to be able to develop those skills within them without necessarily relying heavily on the technology.
Do you think companies and people should be allowed to create and muck around with deep fakes, given fake images and disinformation are pretty rife now?
I think that's a big concern that people have. They want to have the assurance that what they see on their screens is legitimate, particularly from a news perspective. Completely understand from an entertainment, if people are fully aware, they're fully conscious of the fact that something might be a fake, but it's used in a particular context that might be about entertainment, then that's a totally different thing. But the way in which misinformation might influence the way in which we as a community make our decisions about things, and particularly from a parliamentary perspective that might be guided in that way, you got to think carefully about it. And so online safety and within the realm of the Minister for Communications, Michelle Rowland, the eSafety Commissioner, is thinking a lot around that and working with companies on that. But that is clearly something that, again, is another example of the technology being used in a way that has outcomes that people won't be comfortable with whatsoever. And we do need to have some sort of regulatory response to deal with it.
Hundreds of tech chiefs, including the bosses of some of the biggest AI companies, yesterday released a statement warning that this could lead to the extinction of humanity. Should people be frightened and on alert over this?
not be careful about. Look, my take, Sabra, I mean, you may be aware, I've followed technology for years well before
a long time.
Entering into politics. I always take this view. I'm not an evangelist about it, and I don't catastrophize. You know, technology will be used in a range of different ways. The main thing is we want to use it for benefit rather than ill. And they want the assurance, the confidence that those type of risks are being, one, recognised and something's being done about it, but not in a way that throttles the use of the technology, because this can have benefits. I mean, AI, for example, you know, if you've got a choice, you know, you're worried about your health, you're concerned you might potentially have cancer, you've had your screening done, and you can use AI to be able to draw off hundreds of thousands of images that have been able to detect trends in the way that cancer has evolved, and that you can get a definite diagnosis within a short space of time, you'd want AI to do that. But at the same time, would you want that diagnosis just to be spat out on a receipt out of a machine, or would you want someone to walk you through that? And this is the classic, case here, Sabra, that we want the technology to be able to deliver for us, but we want people, the people-to-people interaction that helps, gives us that comfort and assurance about how the technology is being used. And it's, in a sense, a double check to make sure that everything is okay. So I think we've got to get that balance right. That's the big thing here.
Ed Husic, thanks for talking to AM.
Thank you, Sabra.
And Ed Husic is the Minister for Industry and Science. In a month, the National Anti-Corruption Commission will be up and running, and the federal government says it'll be up to the new agency to decide if it'll launch an investigation into the PwC tax scandal. Meanwhile, the tax regulator has asked the consultancy firm to hand over the names of the 9 partners who've been directed to take leave. With more, here's political reporter Noor Haider.
For almost 2 weeks, the tax leak scandal engulfing PwC Australia has been the focus at Senate estimates. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, isn't hiding his anger about the firm's actions.
I am personally, the government, I think the country is absolutely filthy about what's happened with PwC.
The government's already made changes around the procurement of contracts, and speaking on 7:30, Mr Chalmers hinted it'd be reluctant to sign new contracts with the firm.
Part of the changes that Katie Gallagher and her finance department have been talking about is making sure that we take character and past behaviour into consideration when we make new contracts. And I think you can read into that what you will.
While the AFP is now investigating the circulation of confidential Commonwealth tax information, the Greens say a probe by the National Anti-Corruption Commission, which begins operating soon, is what's needed. Here's Greens Senator Barbara Pocock.
This matter should be at the top of the list of the National Anti-Corruption Commission on the 1st of July.
The Greens want Labor to back a referral to the commission. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Attorney General says the agency is completely independent of the government and it'll be entirely a matter for the Commission to determine what it investigates. At Senate estimates yesterday, the chair of the Tax Practitioners Board, Peter DeCuer, revealed the regulator is still looking into PwC.
We are making some further inquiries.
Last year, the TPB terminated the registration of former PwC partner Peter John Collins after uncovering the leaks and ordered the firm to improve training for its staff around managing conflicts of interest. But Senator Pocock questioned why it didn't take tougher action against PwC.
So why haven't you suspended PwC's registration as a tax practitioner?
We imposed the sanctions on PwC that were about making sure that these problems did not occur again in the future.
The TPB has now requested the firm provide the names of the 9 partners who were stood down pending the outcome of an internal investigation. A spokesperson for PwC says it will respond to the request. Senator Pocock says there are still many unanswered questions.
We are witnessing a multi-institutional failure. And I think many people out there who are listening are asking, why does such a large company get off so lightly when the average taxpayer doesn't?
That's Greens Senator Barbara Pocock ending Noor Haider's report. Another big gap in Tasmania's already strained health services is looming, with three psychiatrists closing their Hobart practices because a private hospital is shutting down. Two of the doctors are warning it'll create significant shortages in mental health care in the state, as Alexandra Humphreys reports.
In 3 weeks, psychiatrist Dr. Marjana Rybak's career in private practice will come to an abrupt end.
I'm devastated that's what's happening to the hospital and to our practice.
With 2,000 patients on her books, Dr. Rybak has worked as a consultant psychiatrist at the St. Helens Private Hospital in Hobart for 20 years. The facility has 31 adult mental health beds, day patient programs, and an 8-bed mother and baby unit. But its owners, Healthscope, are closing the hospital from the end of this month because it can't afford necessary upgrades.
We are forced to close the practice, and we have no place to admit the people who need hospitalisation. So that's devastating for us as clinicians and devastating for the patients who are in our care. I see a lot of patients of a high to moderate risk and severity of psychiatric illness. I'm not prepared to take that risk to manage them on an outpatient basis, and but it would be the risk not only for the patient but also for me.
Consultant psychiatrist Dr. Yvonne Turnier-Shea has made the same decision for similar reasons.
The 30 private beds, that doesn't mean just 31 patients. That's like thousands of people admitted in a year through those beds.
The Tasmanian government has already announced a new mother and baby unit at the Royal Hobart Hospital, and it's working with private providers to transition some of the other services. Premier Jeremy Rockliffe is also the health minister.
We're actively working with St Helens Private Hospital, other providers as well, such as the Hobart Clinic, to ensure that we do have the services available and support people in the community that require that care.
Dr. Turnier-Shea says Tasmania's public mental health services are already strained, and she's concerned her patients will fall through the gaps.
None of those beds or none of those facilities are new, and none of them are extra help to what's going to be a great vacuum of lack of care.
A third psychiatrist has also told the ABC they're shutting their practice too. Connie DeGolis is from the Mental Health Council of Tasmania.
I think the most important thing is also to be reassuring people that while this service is closing, all steps that we believe can be taken are being taken to ensure that in the short term, especially those specific treatments, are actually still going to be available to people.
She stresses that care will remain available for those who need it.
That report from Alexandra Humphreys and Loretta Loberger. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. It's been one of Australia's biggest legal cases. Today, a federal court judge will deliver his verdict in the Ben Robert Smith defamation trial. The Afghanistan War veteran and Victoria Cross recipient is suing media company Nine Entertainment for defamation over newspaper articles alleging that he's a war criminal. Nick Grimm reports.
10 years ago, Ben Robert Smith was a celebrated war hero, a veteran asked to give his reflections on the Anzac spirit of courage under fire, service to others, and sacrifice.
And that's what we do today. We go away because it's the right thing to do. I think that really shows what type of person, what type of people we are.
But a decade on, the former SAS corporal insists his reputation was destroyed by a series of newspaper articles, which he insists wrongly labelled him as a war criminal, a liar, a bully towards colleagues, and an abusive boyfriend. Now, a federal court judge will decide whether the allegations published by the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and the Canberra Times defamed Ben Robert Smith, and whether he's entitled to be compensated for the damage to his standing in the community. It's the culmination of a long-running trial that in itself generated a media maelstrom, as the case examined evidence detailing the nature of the allegations levelled against the Victoria Cross winner.
Ben Robert Smith has broken down while giving evidence in court today in his defamation case against Nine newspapers.
Ben Robert Smith has accused a serving SAS member of lying about a Taliban raid in 2009.
Estimates suggest the cost of the long-running trial has run into the tens of millions of dollars, with dozens of witnesses called by both sides. Relying on a defence of truth, the newspapers allege Ben Robert Smith was involved in the murder of five unarmed Afghan prisoners while serving there with the SAS. The trial also heard from the 42-year-old's former lover, who claimed he'd been violent towards her. Ben Robert Smith strenuously denies those allegations. The case was brought at a time of heightened scrutiny of Australia's role in the Afghan conflict, with the release of the 2020 Brereton Report, which recommended 19 members of the Special Forces be further investigated over their alleged conduct in Afghanistan. The director of the Media and Communications Law Research Network at the University of Melbourne Law School, Jason Bosland, says both sides have much riding on the outcome of the defamation action.
Whichever way it goes, the stakes are high. So if Ben Robert Smith wins, then of course that's vindication for his reputation, but it also is potentially significant, well, it is significant for the media because of the costs involved, but also just the issue of public interest journalism. And so these articles were pieces of serious investigative journalism, and by relying upon the truth defence and failing, I think that that might have a damaging effect, actually, when it comes to potentially public perceptions of public interest journalism.
That's Jason Boslin, Associate Professor at Melbourne University's Law School. Nick Grimm reporting there. Ultra endurance running is growing in popularity. Athletes push their physical and mental limits as they run long distances, often hundreds of kilometres over several days. And for one of Australia's best ultra athletes, the next national event presents a new challenge because he's tackling it alongside his 14-year-old son. Harrison Tippett reports.
On the trail snaking through the Yuyangs Regional Park, north of Geelong, father and son ultra-running duo Tim and Ollie Kaprzak are notching up the kilometres in yet another training session. Tim is an industrial sparky and one of the country's top ultra-endurance athletes, running and winning events spanning hundreds of kilometres and days at a time.
With ultra-running, it's a suffering sport.
Ollie is a fairly typical 14-year-old. He doesn't like waking up early, and his days are usually spent hitting the books at school. But he's also following his father's footsteps.
Three,
two.
One, go!
Woo!
Good luck, Ollie!
And he's hit his stride early, placing eighth in a marathon through the Yarra Ranges National Park in April, which included a knee-aching 2,000 metres of elevation gain, racing against adults. Both Tim and Ollie will take on the National Backyard Masters in Queensland this month, an event where competitors run a 6.7-kilometre yard every hour on the hour until they simply can't run another. Tim's record in the event is 51 yards, or 342 kilometres in a bit more than 2 days. And Ollie's wildcard entry gives him a chance to set a PB of his own.
Well, I'd be keen on getting 15 hours, but I'd be pushing to get 24. I'd like that. Last time I got 6, which I was disappointed with, but it's a really good effort considering my first time. But I've gotten stronger and everything, so I reckon I'll give it a good go.
Tim knows the nature of ultra running means Ollie will be testing the limits of his developing body and mind.
The mental side of that is the hardest bit, because when you any other race that you start, you know that it's going to end. Whereas this, it doesn't end. It just keeps going and going. The hallucinations get pretty bad.
But Tim also knows he'll be alongside Ollie every step of the way.
I love it. I think that there's nothing greater than being able to do something that you love with your son or with your daughter or with a family member. For me, it's always been, you know, it gives me a really good spectrum of what I can achieve and what the other end looks like. So the harder things in life aren't as hard anymore. If Ollie can maybe pick up on some of that, then I think that, you know, moving forward and as he matures, he'll find a lot of strength in that.
For a teenager, Ollie has a very adult outlook on why he wants to take on ultra events.
I can't help being not as good as other people, so that's why I want to be the best version of myself that I can be. And it'd just be cool to make a career out of running. I just want to be the best version of myself.
Teenage ultra runner Ollie Kaprzak, ending that report by Harrison Tippett. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
The government pays private consulting firms hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars every year, but can we really trust they're acting in our best interests? Today, host of Radio National's The Money, Richard Aidey, on the PwC scandal and whether it will change who the government does business with. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.